I'm joined today by Nicolas Dorier, creator of the End Bitcoin Project. Welcome, Nicolas.
Hi, thanks, Brian.
Nicolas, can you tell us a little bit about what Bitcoin is, please?
So Bitcoin is what we call a decentralized currency. So what does it mean? It means that no company is behind it, and most importantly, no government or no entity can stop it from spreading or can control the money supply. And so what it means is that everybody can, we'll talk about later, but can verify transactions on the Bitcoin network or confirm transaction. I will talk about a bit about these two differences later. And so the big deal of that is that we will not have any payment intermediary like PayPal that's already abused their power. And for example, I will talk about what, if you permit me to report that now.
Yep, sure, no problem.
I will talk about why I start being interested in Bitcoin, because at the start, most of people think that it's just like a new startup that tried to create a new money. That's what I thought it was before. And the thing is that I thought about that, and one day I listened to an interview between the CIO of Google and Julian Assange. And the two, both of them were talking about Bitcoin because Julian Assange had a problem. It was that all their payment system were frozen without any justice court, justice order. So they tried to shut up WikiLeaks by illegal means. And so the only, what he was talking about was that the only means to get some funds for the company was to pass by Bitcoin. And then he explained, in this interview, explained to Sergey how the Bitcoin works. And that's how I got started and tried to learn more about it.
Hmm. You were saying that it's a decentralized currency that can be verified by individual users and there's no intermediaries. Can you explain that a little bit, please?
Yeah. So the thing is that to understand that, you have to understand a little bit how the Bitcoin protocol work. Basically, what Bitcoin is a what we call a distributed ledger. It means that every time someone make a transaction, it will spread it in a peer-to-peer network, and everyone will spread their transaction to everybody else. Okay? So these transactions will eventually get in the hands of what we call miners. So most of people have heard about that. And what miners does is trying to what we call confirm a transaction. That means that even if the transaction is verified, that means that it doesn't try what I will talk about later, double spend, or it's not a, it is a well-formatted transaction, then you need to confirm that with a miner. And so all the miner take all these transactions in their hand and try to create what we call a block. And you have one block with all these transactions inside every 10 minutes, approximately. And when the miners find a block, it will spread this solution to everybody else, and it will gain some Bitcoin. Currently, it's 55 per block, plus all the fees, all the transaction fees that he confirmed. So it gives him an incentive to act and maintain the Bitcoin network without us knowing him. So the big thing that we need to understand in Bitcoin is that contrary to our current system, when, for example, in the system of today, if two person want to exchange, to trade between themselves, they try to put legal boundary to not be, to prevent fraud. You know, for example, if you buy something through PayPal and the seller doesn't send you the goods, then you can tell to PayPal to try to attack him, to get your money back. And that's why we need this sort of intermediary. But in Bitcoin, where everybody is anonymous on this network, you can't rely on the legal system to defend yourself. So what Bitcoin does is trying to build some incentive to make sure that everybody act rightly, have economical incentive to act rightly. So maybe I will take another example. For example, imagine that you want to buy, say, a car from someone you doesn't know and you don't trust him. Okay? But, like I said, you can't use the legal system to defend yourself because you two are anonymous. So what you are doing is what we call an escrow system. It means that between the two parties, you will have what we call a trusted party. But contrary to PayPal, this trusted party doesn't know either of you. Okay? So it can't attack or coerce either of you. And what the buyer will do is take his Bitcoin and send it into an account that is owned by the buyers and by the third party. We call that an escrow. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that once this money is shared between both of them, the buyer can't get it back without the approval of the third party. And reversely, if the third party can't take the money with him and spend it without the approval and send it to the seller without the approval of the buyer. So in fact, it's controlled by two private key and nobody can spend without having the two private key. And so what will be is that the seller will then send the core to the buyer, and then the buyer will say to the third party, yes, I received my core. You can unlock the funds and send it to the seller. If the seller doesn't send the core, he will never get the money because the buyer will not agree to send the money back. Okay? And the seller know that the buyer has the money because he has the proof that the Bitcoin are held by this trusted third party. So in fact, we have a system where both can trade something and both have economical incentive to not fraud anybody.
So, are there some fees associated with this intermediary escrow system?
Currently, there is some fee, but I think it's maybe 0.5%, something like that. But I mean, you don't, in the long term, I think such service will be free because the thing is that everybody can do it. You know, the third party can also be anonymous, but have a reputation. So everybody, if a trust party try to abuse by charging lots of fees, then other trust party will come into the market. So I think it will be, the fees of such party will not be very high because they doesn't risk anything.
At the start, it seemed it was easy for an individual to mine a Bitcoin. But now, from what I'm reading, you need clusters of custom machines, lots of electricity, access to a cheap electricity network like Iceland. Has that changed the claims about Bitcoin, democracy, and the usage of Bitcoin?
This is a good question because it's somewhat controversial, right? Actually, because you're right. Actually, everybody could try to mine Bitcoin with his own machine and expect some return on that. Okay. But currently, the problem is that as an individual, you can always mine by yourself, but you will maybe get one block every 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, because there is a lot of, in fact, in the Bitcoin network, everybody is giving computing resource to find, to mine these blocks. And your chance of getting that block depends on your, on the percentage of computing power you give to the network. And currently it's huge. So as an individual, you're right. It's almost impossible to get any buy Bitcoin. So that's what we call the variance problem. We call that variance because it means that you will win one time a lot of money, but once upon maybe 20 or 30 years. Okay. So what was created in the Bitcoin system was what we call mining pools. And what a mining pools does is to decrease this variance. So instead of say earning 25 Bitcoin in 20 years, maybe you will earn, I don't know, maybe 0.5 Bitcoin every 6 months. That's what we call variance. And your question actually about does it change claims about Bitcoin and democracy is rightful, because what's going on today is that those mining pools are company, okay? And they have lots of economies of scale because they can buy lots of hardware way cheaper than us, okay? So when you want to be a miner, you don't have to invest in any hardware. You just lend the hardware of a mining pool. And currently there was a small crash in Bitcoin because one of the biggest mining pool, it's called gh.io, got 51% of mining power of the whole network. So why does it change, what does it change, claims about Bitcoin and democracy? Is that from the day that a miner gets 51% of the network, he can change the rules of Bitcoin if he wants. And that means that, for example, he can create what we call an alternate chain. It means that he's trying to create blocks on the side without publishing it on the network. Everybody continue to mine their blocks. But if the mining pool gets more than 51%, it will always build blocks faster than the main network. Okay? So what will happen is that at one point, the mining pool can publish its chain of blocks. And what it will do is that it will cancel every blocks that was on the network that was published before. Because what's going on is that when two people mine a block at the same time, for a short period of time, you will have what we call two chain on the networks, two value chain. But what happen when Bitcoin does that is that one of the chain will build faster than the other. And one of both will be dropped. So all the block from one chain will be dropped. So that's what changed the claim about democracy, is that it's a very dangerous situation we are in, that one company have 51% of the network. Sure, they don't have any economic incentive to cheat the system, but they can always be corrupted to do so by political intervention or stuff like that. So right now there is the Bitcoin community try to develop what we call P2 pool. That is a mining pool, that decrease the variance, but that is not owned by a single company. But right now it's very small. So it's a problem that Bitcoin has, this centralization of mining power. And I hope that it will, the P2 pool alternative will gain in popularity, because for now it's, I think, dangerous personally.
Regarding the likes of the commercial mining pools, they've got a lot of money. People are renting power from them. Is it fair to say that effectively Bitcoins have now become a resource for rich companies to make money?
So it depends. For the mining pools, yeah, Bitcoins, for the mining pools, clearly Bitcoins is one way to make lots of money. So that's for sure. But I think, actually company will earn more money by using Bitcoin as alternative payment system because of the fees that they will save. So for example, right now, in the past, I get paid by a customer that is in America, and I get paid by PayPal. Okay. So firstly, that was that people, take something between 1.8% and 3.4% of commissions. Okay. But what they don't tell you is that my customer was paying me in dollar, and I wanted to convert the money in euro. And the price of the conversion between the two currency had a small fees. It's written in the contract, but you have to search for it. They don't show it clearly. So what happened is that one day I decided to make a test, asking my customer to pay me on his side and get the money on my bank account all the way down. And I calculated after all that I was something like 7% of fees, even if officially I was thinking it was 3%. So that's a kind of behavior that screwed up entrepreneurs to use any payment intermediary. So, so that's a nice part. Those are parts that if you make lots of money on PayPal, they will block your money, for whatever reason, saying that they want to control, that it's not fraud, or they always have good reason. But the fact is that they freeze your money without your consent. And so that's the kind of behavior that is very, harmful for entrepreneurs. And I believe that most of them, lots of them will start to think about Bitcoin as a way to get rid of such system.
But with regard to Bitcoin, we have seen the value of it decrease significantly. So you are, you know, you're facing a possibility of a 7% fee through PayPal or a 5% fee through someone else. But you could have a 50% loss on a Bitcoin from one day to the next, potentially.
So, yeah. So, you have two ways to use Bitcoin. What you can do is to use what we call exchanges that convert this Bitcoin to money. So what you can do is that asking my customer to pay me in Bitcoin on his country, I receive the Bitcoin and then use an exchange to get the money back in euro. And the fees are way less than PayPal by doing that.
Okay, so you wouldn't keep your Bitcoins necessarily. You would just use it as a way of transferring the money and then turning it back into a standard
That's
currency.
A possibility, yeah. Personally, I keep the Bitcoin as is because I'm sure that there will be lots of new usage that will come. And I may be wrong. And for example, maybe the mining problem I told you will be a big problem in the future. It's possible, but I believe in it. And so I keep my Bitcoin.
So I've heard about a lot of companies that will store Bitcoins for you in the likes of vaults, some of them even offering insurance. But given what happened in Mt. Gox, I get the impression that the best way to store a Bitcoin is written on a piece of paper and under the bed. What do you think?
So That's a very good question. And the thing is that, as some of you know, and as you know, is that a big company that was very trust was Mt. Gox. That was a Japanese company that kept your Bitcoin in a vault, they said. But people have to be very careful about that, because in the case of Mt. Gox, they say that it was a hack and that got all of their money. But the thing is, with Bitcoin, you have no proof that the hack is not an internal hack, maybe by the founder. You don't know. It's possible, but nobody will be able to prove it. And so basically what people should try to learn about is to secure their own fund. You know, we are very used to keep our money safe at banks right now, because for a long period of time we didn't have any bankruptcy, and so we are very confident about that. But we need I think that most of the people should take the responsibility of their own money. For example, what happened, you already heard about the Greek banks, the Cyprus banks, that I've gone bankrupt, and it lost money of the depositor. So what happened to Mt. Gox is not only on the Bitcoin world, it happened also in the banking world. And the funny thing is that all the political will say, yeah, it will never happen, it can only happen to Greek and stuff like that. But what are the proof? If you look at the history, it already happened, and I think it will happen again. So to come back to your question, is the safest way to secure your Bitcoin is, as you said, what we do, making what we call cold storage. So you have two way of doing that. You can print your private key on the piece of paper. So that's what I tell to my dad, because you know, he's all. I pushed him to invest in Bitcoin, and I gave him the private key on the paper and say, keep it and copy it everywhere you want, but keep it safe. So that's one way of doing it. There's another way that are called cold wallets. And one company I can talk about is Trezor. This company created what we call a cold storage wallet. It means that you have a physical wallet, it's a USB key. And the private key is inside this device. Okay? And basically, when you want to make a transaction in Bitcoin, the private key always stay on the device. It never transits on your own computer, so you can't be hacked. You cannot be hacked. So what happened is that when you want to sign a transaction on Bitcoin, your computer will send this transaction unsigned on the Trezor key. The Trezor key will sign it internally and send it back to your computer. So your key are safe, even if your computer have viruses. Viruses, it cannot store the key. So one thing that is true is that. And I mean, you're a developer, so maybe you are aware of the bad security practice of the normal people.
I've seen a few things.
I always make nightmare about that. And so that's true that for them, they're not ready to keep lots of money on their computer. They can't be trusted with that. It's a big security issue. And so one thing that I will recommend is for them is to have several key. One key that where they will hold only a smaller amount of Bitcoin that they can afford to lose, that they will keep on their computer. And most of the money on the, say, on a cold key that they will store under the mattress or copy everywhere or stuff like that. So yeah, it's what I mean is that's a point that is difficult for Bitcoin for the general public, because they were never taught about securing their own money. But with Bitcoin, you have all the power to create your own account, to put exactly the amount of money you want to risk and to store it where you want. So one example I have. Imagine for now, I'm sure it's always happened for you. You subscribe to a service on internet. You know, you have a monthly subscription to it. And then when you want to stop the service, you tell them, I want to stop. They say, okay, but they keep getting your money.
Happened to me with a magazine subscription, yes.
Yeah, and it happened to everybody. It happens to me and it happened to everybody. With Bitcoin, there is an interesting stuff you can do to prevent such things. And you don't need any bank for that. What you do is to create an account that is protected by two key. But instead of having the two key needed to spend the funds on it, like I told you for the escrow system, what you can say is to say any of the two key can spend. So for example, if you want to remove your, if you want to pick your subscription, you put, I don't know, maybe 3 months ahead on this account, then your service will take money each month on that. But when you want to unsubscribe, you take back the fund on your own key. So the company will not be able to take more than you permit to. And you don't have banks for that. It's built in into Bitcoin. So that will be a very interesting application of this technology, and it will come. And so it happens to everybody, this kind of still by companies.
So I've read that there are scalability issues in Bitcoin related to its ability to process transactions. Could you please explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's multiple problem of scalability, but I think in the future we'll be able to work around that. So one of the problem is that, for example, the Visa network can process something like 3,000 transactions per second. Compared to that, Bitcoin is around 7 transactions per second.
And when you say 7, you mean 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, as opposed to 7,000.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah,
that's right. So that's an issue that is related to currently what we call the size of a block. You remember when I talk about the miner that want to find blocks? Mm-hmm. These blocks have a lot of transactions inside that. But currently, the size of such block is 1 megabyte maximum. So that means that if you put too much transaction into it, it will go over and your block will not be accepted by the network. And so what's going on is that, like I said, you have one block every 10 minutes. So given these two limitations, you have a maximum of 7 transactions per second that can be done. So that's a problem. But currently there is nothing that prevents Bitcoin developers to lift this limit in the future.
So does that mean if 7 people or 100 people went to Bitcoin ATMs around the world and attempted to withdraw money at more or less the same time, there would be slight delays in the processing?
So, yeah, there's an interesting thing that you're saying, that normally the time to have your transaction confirmed by the network takes normally 10 minutes, right? So if you have an ATM of Bitcoin, you can't really ask to your customer to wait for 10 minutes or more, or maybe more. If there is the maximum throughput, maybe you will have to wait 1 hour to have this transaction confirmed. So you can't really do that because it will, the customer wants this money back now. But there is some work around this kind of stuff. In fact, why do we have to wait 10 minutes? It's because when you create a transaction, you say explicitly which Bitcoin you want to spend. Okay? And all the Bitcoin that you want to spend are identified by a reference on a block that was already mined in the past, that was confirmed It's a sort of chain of transactions. So you have to prove every Bitcoin that they are not already spent. Okay? But imagine that someone creates two transactions to pay two different goods spending the same coins. He can do that because they are both not confirmed at this point. So both transactions will be accepted by a block, but only one of them will be confirmed. So if you give the money right now to the customer and you try to just spend it, then you will give him the money, but it will be canceled because he did another transaction. So that's the problem. But there is some way to prevent such things to happen. Is that, like I said, it's always by using a trusted party. But this trusted party, like I said, it's not like PayPal because it doesn't know nor you, nor the person that you want to pay. So what's going on is that you can have some wallet service that where you will put your phone on an account controlled by the key of the escrow of the third party and your key, your own key. Okay. You will need both to spend the money inside your account. Okay. So what's going on is that imagine that the seller of goods trusts your third party to not double spend, you know, emitting the same transaction to spend the same Bitcoin. We call that a double transaction. Double spending, we call that. If the guy which you send money to trust this trusted party to not double spend, he can accept the transaction right away and confirm it later, because he trusts that the other one will not try to double spend because he owns the key. So even if the buyer, even if the sender want to send the same money to someone else, the trusted party will never sign that. So in this way, you have a possibility to confirm immediately that the payment has been done. So that's a possibility of workaround. So for the scalability, there is another common problem that we heard about is about the memory of it. Like I said, Bitcoin is a distributed ledger. It means that all the transactions that ever happen in the Bitcoin world are tracked. Everybody have access to all of these transactions. Okay. So what it means is that this database of transactions will grow and grow and grow over time. Right now we are about 25 gigabytes. Okay. So, for example, if you use a wallet like Bitcoin QT that downloads the whole blockchain on your computer, it can take something like 1 week to be able to synchronize with the network and takes lots of space. So imagine that in the future, we have the throughput of Visa, that is 3,000 transactions per second. It will be a very big problem that because nobody will be able to afford enough memory to store this whole blockchain. So what will happen eventually that the whole blockchain will not be stored on each computer, but on central nodes that people will start to trust. But when you do that, you come back to the trust problem, because if the person that keeps the blockchain for you decide to lie to you, he can do so if he wants. But that it's one of the problems that we will have. Yeah.
You said that all transactions are tracked from the start of Bitcoin to now in a large sort of file. But we always hear about that Bitcoin is private, that there's anonymity. Can you explain how those two things work together?
Yeah. So in the Bitcoin protocol, you are identified by a public key. Okay, that if you want to get paid, you give your public key to someone else and he will be able to send funds to you. Okay, so you can create such public key offline. You don't have to register it anywhere. So that means that even if all the transactions are tracked, nobody will be able to link the public key information to your personal identity. There is an interesting part that you can have with Bitcoin is that take, for example, a company that want to declare its revenue to the IRS, for example. What you can do is publish its own public key to the IRS, and the IRS will be able to check, because it knows the link between the public key and the company. The central authority will be able to check if the books are right, the books of the company are right. So there is an anonymity as long as you keep the link between the public key and you secret. But for example, if you are a company, you will publish that and it's no more. And so that's what we mean when we talk about anonymity.
And I can create as many public keys as I choose, I presume.
Sorry?
I can create multiple public keys for myself?
That's right. For example, the original wallet software that is called Bitcoin QT, it's the one created by Satoshi. What it does is creating you a pool of, I think at the beginning, it's a pool of hundreds of addresses. And it does that because it keeps your anonymity safe, because even if one of your public key leak and someone can tie your identity to this public key, it will not be able to see the other keys. So yeah, you can create as much as you want. So for example, for me, when I get paid by a customer, they have their own public key where they send funds to. Why? Because if all my customers were giving money to the same key, they will be able to know how much fund I have, and something I want to protect. So you are free to use as much as you want, and it takes no computing power to do that.
Can we go back to the topic of a miner that has 51% of the mining power of the network, how that affects mining and, say, decisions about the network, and then the impact on the democratic aspects of Bitcoin, please?
Okay, so there's two parts about that. One part is about decision making of Bitcoin. The thing is that Bitcoin, to prevent any coercion by some private interests, by private company or by governments, needs to be the decision making need to be distributed. So what it means is that, say some developers want to make a new feature in Bitcoin, they can't just impose such feature without the approval of people. Why? Because if they do it, people will just fork the Bitcoin code and make their own stuff with it. So what developer needs is to be sure that miners will approve their change. So how does it work? So like I said, one miner in the world every 10 minutes find a block. And inside this block, there is some data that he can include. So in this data, he can vote for some feature for the Bitcoin protocol. So what's going on will be that developers will propose a new change in the Bitcoin protocol, and they will say every miners that agree with that will put such data in their block. And after something like 3 months, the developer will count every vote on the blocks, in the blocks that was emitted. And if it's 51%, they will accept the feature and code the feature and distribute the feature. So if one miner gets 51% of the network, the network become weak to any coercion of external individual that doesn't necessarily want the good of the network. So I'm not saying that GHIO is bad into having 51%, that incentive to act rightly, because if Bitcoin crash, they will crash with it. So they can't do as they want. But they can, the problem is that eventually some political power can come and try to coerce them into, or some other private interest, and to coerce them to cheat the network. I give another example, because right now I talk more about the democratic aspect of Bitcoin on the decision making process. But there is another thing that I need to talk about. It's called what we call the 51% attack. So what a 51% attack is, that if a miner get 51% of the processing power of the network, I won't enter in the details, but what he can do, he can cancel the blocks of other miners, because it will be able to calculate a longer chain than others. So what it means is that, imagine that some bad private company make a deal with another company, okay, and there's lots of money at stake. Such company will be able to coerce GH to cancel, maybe after 2 hours, the transaction that they just made. So that's the real problem between in the network, is that GH.io has the power to do so. They won't do it by themselves, but they can be forced to do that. And so that's a big problem that most people have. But don't get me wrong, GH does not want to do that, but it puts us at risk.
I understand. You mentioned, though, that the voting is typically over something like a change to the protocol or a change to the system, and then someone is responsible for coding that change. Who is responsible for making the actual code changes?
So the code changes are done by a group of small group of Bitcoin developers that you can see on GitHub. In fact, the code of Bitcoin is on GitHub. So you will have all the name of the contributor of GitHub on the GitHub. And so how did they got there? I don't really know. What I know is that at one point, I think they know who Satoshi were. Maybe not physically, but they communicated with him. But I don't know where they are here. But if they try to cheat the net, network or the Bitcoin community, the community has the power to take back the code and have other developers to do it better, to do things better.
So is this project open the way a lot of GitHub projects are open for contributions from anyone, or is it limited to a small group at the moment?
No, everyone can contribute to the Bitcoin code. It's just a pull request on GitHub. And what I want to say also is that there is a lot of new cryptocurrency that are creating, for example, Litecoin. There's tons of them that are creating. Most of them are just fork of the Bitcoin protocol with different, some protocol change. And some people think it's bad because it breaks the cryptocurrency market into lots of different segments. But I personally think it's good, because if it happened that the Bitcoin developers do something that people don't want. People will have the power to go into another cryptocurrency or start a new one. And so I think we are relatively safe on that.
Am I right in saying that at some point you will run out of Bitcoins, that there's a hard limit on the number that can be mined?
Yeah, right. Currently, in fact, there is 21 million of Bitcoin that will be ever emitted in the world. I don't remember when the last block, the last Bitcoin emission will be. I think it's in, I don't remember. I think it's in something like 50 years or so. And
that's based on the projections of current processing power and the like.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. In fact, every time a miner find a block, he gain some Bitcoin. Okay. This is where the emission come from of Bitcoin. And this amount of Bitcoin goes slow down every 4 weeks. And it slowed down by two. For example, I think it was in 2010. I'm not sure about that. It was in 2010. The reward, we call that the reward. The reward was, I've gone from 50 Bitcoin per block to 25. And then four years after, it will be divided by two, et cetera, et cetera. And at some point, there will be zero new Bitcoin. And miners will get an incentive to maintain the network, because when you send a transaction on the Bitcoin network, you attach a fee that you will give to the miners that mine the blocks. So for example, you do, a 100 Bitcoin transaction, you will give a fee of, maybe 0.001 Bitcoin. It's very few compared to all processing payments. And the miner that confirmed your transaction will get this fee. So that's all the Bitcoin network will continue to work even without these rewards.
What happens though when all Bitcoins have been mined and everyone's holding on to their Bitcoins because you know the value is going to go up tomorrow? Therefore, you don't use your Bitcoin because you know the value is going to go up tomorrow or the next day or the next day. Isn't there an issue with that?
Yeah. So effectively, the Bitcoin money is what we call a deflationary money. It means that it will become more precious over time. And people say that people will have incentive to keep it instead of buying things. But this is, I mean, this is also a very controversial aspect, because there's lots of economists that have conflicting thoughts about it. And some of them say that people, if, for example, if they want to buy, if they want to buy food, they will not starve with their Bitcoin in their pocket if they need to eat. And so that's true, that people will maybe not spend as much as tomorrow, as today. But I don't know. I'm not an economist on that, but what I will say, that if you want more information about that, you can read what Milton Friedman said about the economy and what, on the other side, Keynes said. It's the two conflictual view on that. So I will not go deep on that because I'm not very familiar with the economics.
That's the end of part one of the interview with Nicola. In part two, we discuss N Bitcoin, colored coins, his contributions to Code Project, and his book choice. The opening music is The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music is titled The Girl by Roulet from the album Beats the More.